This is Audible.
The zombie war came unthinkably close to eradicating humanity. Driven by the need to preserve the first-hand experiences from those apocalyptic years, while they still exist in living memory, Max Brooks traveled across the planet to find and record the testimony of men, women, and sometimes children who came face to face with the living, or at least the undead, hell of that terrible time. World War Z is the result. Some of these voices were chosen for the uniqueness of the perspectives and information they provide. Others are included because they speak for hundreds of millions who were forever silenced. Never before have we had access to a recording that so powerfully conveys the fear and horror, and also the brave spirit of resistance, that gripped human society through the plague years.
Random House Audio presents World War Z by Max Brooks. Read by a full cast.
Introduction. It goes by many names. The Crisis, the Dark Years, the Walking Plague, as well as newer and more hip titles such as World War Z or Z War One. I personally dislike this last moniker as it implies an inevitable Z War Two. For me, it will always be the Zombie War. And while many may protest the scientific accuracy of the word zombie, they will be hard-pressed to discover a more globally accepted term for the creatures that almost caused our extinction. Zombie remains a devastating word, unrivaled in its power to conjure up so many memories or emotions. And it is these memories and emotions that are the subject of this book. This record of the greatest conflict in human history owes its genesis to a much smaller, much more personal conflict between me and the chairperson of the United Nations Post-War Commission report. My initial work for the commission could be described as nothing short of a labor of love. My travel stipend, my security access, my battery of translators, both human and electronic, as well as my small but nearly priceless voice-activated transcription pal, the greatest gift the world's slowest typist could ask for, all spoke to the respect and value my work was afforded on this project. So, needless to say, it came as a shock when I found almost half of that work deleted from the report's final edition. It was all too intimate, the chairperson said during one of our many animated discussions. Too many opinions, too many feelings. That's not what this report is about. We need clear facts and figures, unclouded by the human factor. Of course, she was right. The official report was a collection of cold, hard data, an objective after-action report that would allow future generations to study the events of that apocalyptic decade without being influenced by the human factor. But isn't the human factor what connects us so deeply to our past? Will future generations care as much for chronologies and casualty statistics as they would for the personal accounts of individuals not so different from themselves? By excluding the human factor, aren't we risking the kind of personal detachment from a history that may, heaven forbid, lead us one day to repeat it? And in the end, isn't the human factor the only true difference between us and the enemy we now refer to as the living dead? I presented this argument, perhaps less professionally than was appropriate, to my boss, who, after my final exclamation of, "We can't let these stories die," responded immediately with, "Then don't. Write a book. You've still got all your notes and the legal freedom to use them. Who's stopping you from keeping these stories alive in the pages of your own, expletive deleted, book?" Some critics will, no doubt, take issue with the concept of a personal history book so soon after the end of worldwide hostilities. After all, It has been only 12 years since VA Day was declared in the continental United States, and barely a decade since the last major world power celebrated its deliverance on Victory in China Day. Given that most people consider VC Day to be the official end, then how can we have real perspective when, in the words of a UN colleague, we've been at peace about as long as we were at war? This is a valid argument, and one that begs a response. In the case of this generation, those who have fought and suffered to win us this decade of peace, time is as much an enemy as it is an ally. Yes, the coming years will provide hindsight, adding greater wisdom to memories seen through the light of a matured post-war world. But many of those memories may no longer exist, trapped in bodies and spirits too damaged or infirm to see the fruits of their victory harvested. It is no great secret that global life expectancy is a mere shadow of its former pre-war figure. Malnutrition, pollution, the rise of previously eradicated ailments, even in the United States, with its resurgent economy and universal health care, are the present reality. There simply are not enough resources to care for all the physical and psychological casualties. It is because of this enemy, the enemy of time, that I have forsaken the luxury of hindsight and published these survivors' accounts. Perhaps, decades from now, someone will take up the task of recording the recollections of the much older, much wiser survivors. Perhaps I might even be one of them. Although this is primarily a book of memories, it includes many of the details, technological, social, economic, and so on, found in the original commission report, as they are related to the stories of those voices featured in these pages. This is their book, not mine, and I have tried to maintain as invisible a presence as possible. Those questions included in the text are only there to illustrate those that might have been posed by readers. I have attempted to reserve judgment or commentary of any kind, and if there is a human factor that should be removed, let it be my own.
Part 1. Warnings.
Greater Chongqing, the United Federation of China. At its pre-war height, this region boasted a population of over 35 million people. Now, there are barely 50,000. Reconstruction funds have been slow to arrive in this part of the country, the government choosing to concentrate on the more densely populated coast. There is no central power grid, no running water besides the Yangtze River. But the streets are clear of rubble, and the local security council has prevented any post-war outbreaks. The chairman of that council is Kuang Jingshu, a medical doctor who, despite his advanced age and wartime injuries, still manages to make house calls to all his patients.
The first outbreak I saw was in a remote village that officially had no name. The residents called it Nu Dachang, but this was more out of nostalgia than anything else. Their former home, Old Dachang, had stood since the period of the Three Kingdoms, with farms and houses, and even trees said to be centuries old. When the Three Gorges Dam was completed, and reservoir waters began to rise, much of Dachang had been disassembled, brick by brick, then rebuilt on higher ground. This new Dachang, however, was not a town, but a National Historic Museum. It must have been a heartbreaking irony for those poor peasants to see their town saved, but then only being able to visit it as a tourist. Maybe that is why some of them chose to name their newly constructed hamlet Nu Dachang, to preserve some connection to their heritage, even if it was only in name. I personally didn't know that this other Nu Dachang existed, so you can imagine how confused I was when the call came in. The hospital was quiet. It had been a slow night, even for the increasing number of drunk driving accidents. Motorcycles were becoming very popular. We used to say that your Harley Davidsons kill more young Chinese than all the GIs in the Korean War. That's why I was so grateful for a quiet shift. I was tired. My back and feet ached. I was on my way out to smoke a cigarette and watch the dawn when I heard my name being paged. The receptionist that night was new and couldn't quite understand the dialect. There had been an accident or an illness. It was an emergency. That part was obvious. And could we please send help at once? What could I say? The younger doctors, the kids who think medicine is just a way to pad their bank account, they certainly weren't going to go help some Nongmin just for the sake of helping. I guess I'm still an old revolutionary at heart. Our duty is to hold ourselves responsible to the people. Those words still mean something to me, and I try to remember that. As my deer bounced and banged over dirt roads the government had promised, but never quite gotten around to paving. I had a devil of a time finding the place. Officially, it didn't exist, and therefore wasn't on any map. I became lost several times, and had to ask direction from locals, who kept thinking I meant the museum town. I was in an impatient mood by the time I reached a small collection of hilltop homes. I remember thinking, this had better be damn serious. Once I saw their faces, I regretted my wish. There were seven of them, all on cots, all barely conscious. The villagers had moved them into their new communal meeting hall. The walls and floor were bare cement. The air was cold and damp. Of course they're sick, I thought. I asked the villagers who had been taking care of these people. They said no one. It wasn't safe. I noticed that the door had been locked from the outside. The villagers were clearly terrified. They cringed and whispered. Some kept their distance and prayed. Their behavior made me angry. Not at them, you understand. Not as individuals, but what they represented about our country. After centuries of foreign oppression, exploitation, and humiliation, we were finally reclaiming our rightful place as humanity's middle kingdom. We were the world's richest and most dynamic superpower, masters of everything from outer space to cyberspace. It was the dawn of what the world was finally acknowledging as the Chinese century, and yet so many of us still lived like these ignorant peasants, as stagnant and superstitious as the earliest Yangzhou savages. I was still lost in my grand cultural criticism when I knelt to examine the first patient. She was running a high fever, 40 degrees centigrade, and she was shivering violently. Barely coherent, she whimpered slightly when I tried to move her limb. There was a wound in her right forearm, a bite mark. As I examined it closer, I realized that it wasn't from an animal. The bite radius and teeth mark had to have come from a small or possibly young human being. Although I hypothesized this to be the source of the infection, the actual injury was surprisingly clean. I asked the villagers again who had been taking care of these people. Again, they told me no one. I knew this could not be true. The human mouth is packed with bacteria, even more so than the most unhygienic dog. If no one had cleaned this woman's wound, why wasn't it throbbing with infection? I examined the six other patients. All show similar symptoms. All had similar wounds on various parts of their bodies. I asked one man, the most lucid of the group, who or what had inflicted these injuries. He told me it had happened when they had tried to subdue him. Who? I asked. I found patient zero behind the locked door of an abandoned apartment across town. He was 12 years old. His wrists and feet were bound with plastic packing twine. Although he'd rubbed off the skin around his bonds, there was no blood. There was also no blood on his other wounds, not on the gouges on his leg or arms, or from the large dry gap where his right big toe had been. He was writhing like an animal. A gag muffled his growls. At first, the villagers tried to hold me back. They warned me not to touch him, that he was cursed. I shrugged them off and reached for my mask and gloves. The boy's skin was as cold and gray as the cement on which he lay. I could find neither his heartbeat nor his pulse. His eyes were wild, wide, and sunken back in their sockets. They remained locked on me like a predatory beast. Throughout the examination, he was inexplicably hostile, reaching for me with his bound hands and snapping at me through his gag. His movements were so violent, I had to call for two of the largest villagers to help me hold him down. At first, they wouldn't budge, cowering in the doorway like baby rabbits. I explained that there was no risk of infection if they used gloves and mask. When they shook their heads, I made it an order, even though I had no lawful authority to do so. That was all it took. The two oxen knelt beside me. One held the boy's feet, while the other grasped his hands. I tried to take a blood sample and instead extracted only brown, viscous matter. As I was withdrawing the needle, the boy began another bout of violent struggling. One of my orderlies, the one responsible for his arm, gave up trying to hold them and thought it might be safer if he just braced them against the floor with his knees. But the boy jerked again, and I heard his left arm snap. Jagged ends of both radius and ulna bones stabbed through his gray flesh. Although the boy didn't cry out, didn't even seem to notice, it was enough for both assistants to leap back and run from the room. The boy began to twist in my direction, his arm ripped completely free. Flesh and muscle tore from one another until there was nothing except a stump. His now free right arm, still tied to the severed left hand, dragged his body across the floor. I hurried outside, locking the door behind me. I tried to compose myself, control my fear and shame. My voice still cracked as I asked the villagers how the boy had been infected. A young woman came forward, maybe his mother. You could tell that she had been crying for days. Her eyes were dry and deeply red. She admitted that it had happened when the boy and his father were moon fishing, a term that describes diving for treasure among the sunken ruins of the Three Gorges Reservoir. With more than 1,100 abandoned villages, towns, and even cities, there was always the hope of recovering something valuable. It was a very common practice in those days, and also very illegal. She explained that they weren't looting, that it was their own village, Old Dachang, and they were just trying to recover some heirlooms from the remaining houses that hadn't been moved. She repeated the point, and I had to interrupt her with promises not to inform the police. She finally explained that the boy came up crying with a bite mark on his foot. He didn't know what had happened. The water had been too dark and muddy. His father was never seen again. I reached for my cell phone and dialed the number of Dr. Gu Wenkui, an old comrade from my army days who now worked at the Institute of Infectious Diseases at Chongqing University. We exchanged pleasantries, discussing our health, our grandchildren. It was only proper. I then told him about the outbreak and listened as he made some joke about the hygiene habits of hillbillies. I tried to chuckle along, but continued that I thought the incident might be significant. Almost reluctantly, he asked me what the symptoms were. I told him everything. The bites, the fever, the boy, the arm. His face suddenly stiffened. His smile died. He asked me to show him the infected. I went back into the meeting hall and waved the phone's camera over each of the patients. He asked me to move the camera closer to some of the wounds themselves. I did so, and when I brought the screen back to my face, I saw that his video image had been cut. "Stay where you are," he said, just a distant, removed voice now. "Take the names of all who had contact with the infected. Restrain those already infected. If any have passed into coma, vacate the room and secure the exit. His voice was flat, robotic, as if he had rehearsed this speech or was reading from something. His voice softened for just a minute, just a second of human concern. He asked me, "Are you armed?" "Why would I be?" I asked. He told me he would get back to me, all business again. He said he had to make a few calls and that I should expect support within several hours. They were there in less than 50 men in large Army Z-8A helicopters. All were wearing hazardous material suits. They said they were from the Ministry of Health. I don't know who they thought they were kidding. With their bullying swagger, their intimidating arrogance, even these backwater bumpkins could recognize the Guanbu. Their first priority was the meeting hall. The patients were carried out on stretchers, their limbs shackled, their mouths gagged. Next, they went for the boy. He came out in a body bag. His mother was wailing as she and the rest of the village were rounded up for examinations. Their names were taken, their blood drawn. One by one, they were stripped and photographed. The last one to be exposed was a withered old woman. She had a thin, crooked body, a face with a thousand lines and tiny feet that had to have been bound when she was a girl. She was shaking her bony fist at the doctors. "This is your punishment," she shouted. "This is revenge for Feng Du." She was referring to the city of ghosts, whose temples and shrines were dedicated to the underworld. Like old Dachang, it had been an unlucky obstacle to China's next great leap forward. It had been evacuated, then demolished, then almost entirely drowned. I've never been a superstitious person, and I never allow myself to be hooked on the opium of the people. I'm a doctor, a scientist. I believe only in what I can see and touch. I've never seen Feng Du as anything but a cheap, kitschy tourist trap. Of course, this ancient crone's words had no effect on me, but her tone, her anger. She had witnessed enough calamity in her years upon the earth. The warlords, the Japanese, the insane nightmare of the Cultural Revolution. She knew that another storm was coming, even if she didn't have the education to understand it. My colleague, Dr. Kui, had understood all too well. He'd even risked his neck to warn me, to give me enough time to call and maybe alert a few others before the Ministry of Health arrived. It was something he had said, a phrase. A phrase he hadn't used in a very long time, not since those minor border clashes with the Soviet Union. That was back in 1969. We had been in an earthen bunker on our side of the Usuri, less than a kilometer downriver from the Chenbao. The Russians were preparing to retake the island, their massive artillery hammering our forces. Gu and I had been trying to remove a shrapnel from the belly of this soldier not much younger than us. The boy's lower intestine had been torn open. His blood and excrement were all over our gowns. Every 7 seconds, a round would land close by and we would have to bend over his body to shield the wound from falling earth, and every time we would be close enough to hear him whimper softly for his mother. There were other voices, too, rising from the pitch darkness, just beyond the entrance to our bunker. Desperate, angry voices that weren't supposed to be on our side of the river. We had two infantrymen stationed at the bunker's entrance. One of them shouted, "Spetsnaz!" and started firing into the dark. We could hear other shots now as well. Ours or theirs, we couldn't tell. Another round hit and we bent over the dying boy. Gu's face was only a few centimeters from mine. There was sweat pouring down his forehead. Even in the dim light of one paraffin lantern, I could see that he was shaking and pale. He looked at the patient, then at the doorway, then at me, and suddenly he said, "Don't worry, everything's going to be all right." Now, this is a man who had never said a positive thing in his life. Gu was a warrior, a neurotic curmudgeon. If he had a headache, it was a brain tumor. If it looked like rain, this year's harvest was ruined. This was his way of controlling the situation, his lifelong strategy for always coming out ahead. Now, when reality looked more dire than any of his fatalistic predictions, he had no choice but to turn tail and charge in the opposite direction. Don't worry, everything gonna be all right. For the first time, everything turned out as he predicted. The Russian never crossed the river, and we even managed to save our patient. For years afterward, I would tease him about what it took to pry out a little ray of sunshine, and he would always respond that it would take a hell of a lot worse to get him to do it again. Now we were old men, and something worse was about to happen. It was right after he asked me if I was armed. No, I said, why should I be? There was a brief silence. I'm sure other ears were listening. Don't worry, he said. Everything gonna be all right. That was when I realized that this was not an isolated outbreak. I ended the call and quickly placed another to my daughter in Guangzhou. Her husband worked for China Telecom and spent at least 1 week of every month abroad. I told her it would be a good idea to accompany him the next time he left, and she should take my granddaughter and stay for as long as they could. I didn't have time to explain. My signal was jammed just as the first helicopter appeared. The last thing I managed to say to her was, "Don't worry. Everything's going to be all right."
Kuang Jishu was arrested by the MSS and incarcerated without formal charges. By the time he escaped, the outbreak had spread beyond China's borders. Lhasa, the People's Republic of Tibet. The world's most populous city is still recovering from the results of last week's general election. The Social Democrats have smashed the Lamaist Party in a landslide victory, and the streets are still roaring with revelers. I meet Nuri Telavaldi at a crowded sidewalk cafe. We have to shout over the euphoric din.
Before the outbreak started, overland smuggling was never popular. To arrange for the passports, the fake tour buses, the contacts and protection on the other side all took a lot of money. Back then, the only two lucrative routes were into Thailand or Myanmar. Where I used to live in Kashi, the only option was into the ex-Soviet republics. No one wanted to go there, and that is why I wasn't initially a shatu. I was an importer. Raw opium, uncut diamonds, girls, boys, whatever was valuable from those primitive excuses for countries. The outbreak changed all that. Suddenly we were besieged with offers, and not just from the Liudong Rinku, but also, as you say, from people on the up and up. I had urban professionals, private farmers, even low-level government officials. These were people who had a lot to lose. They didn't care where they were going. They just needed to get out.
Did you know what they were fleeing?
We'd heard the rumors. We'd even had an outbreak somewhere in Kashi. The government had hushed it up pretty quickly. But we guessed, we knew something was wrong. But Kashi was a boomtown. I think 90%, maybe more, of all westbound overland traffic came through with even a little left over for air travel.
Air travel?
Just a little. I only dabbled in transporting Rinchi by air. A few cargo flights now and then to Kazakhstan or Russia. Small-time jobs. It wasn't like the East, where Guangdong or Jiangsu were getting thousands of people out every week.
You say they didn't call for a doctor, that they were afraid they'd be sent back. But then why try to find a cure in the West?
You don't really understand a refugee's heart, do you? These people were desperate. They were trapped between the infections and being rounded up and treated by their own government. If you had a loved one, a family member, a child who was infected, and you thought there was a shred of hope in some other country, wouldn't you do everything in your power to get there? Wouldn't you want to believe there was hope?
Did you see many infected?
Not in the beginning. The blight worked too fast. It wasn't like air travel. It might take weeks to reach Kashi, and even the slowest of burns, I've been told, couldn't last longer than a few days. Infected clients usually reanimated somewhere on the road, where they would be recognized and collected by the local police. Later, as the infestations multiplied and the police became overwhelmed, I began to see a lot of infected on my route.
Were they dangerous?
Rarely. Their family usually had them bound and gagged. You'd see something moving in the back of a car, squirming softly under clothing or heavy blankets. You'd hear banging from a car's boot or later from crates with air holes in the back of vans. Air holes. They really didn't know what was happening to their loved ones.
Did you?
By then, yes, but I knew trying to explain it to them would be a hopeless cause. I just took their money and sent them on their way. I was lucky. I never had to deal with the problems of sea smuggling.
That was more difficult.
And dangerous. My associates from the coastal provinces were the ones who had to contend with the possibility of an infected breaking its bonds and contaminating the entire hold.
What did they do?
I've heard of various solutions. Sometimes ships would pull up to a stretch of deserted coast. It didn't matter if it was the intended country. It could have been any coast. And unload the infected wrenchy onto the beach. I've heard of some captains making for an empty stretch of open sea and just tossing the whole riding lot overboard. That might explain the early cases of swimmers and divers starting to disappear without a trace. Or why you'd hear of people all around the world saying they saw them walking out of the surf. At least I never had to deal with that. I did have one similar incident, the one that convinced me it was time to quit. There was this truck, a beat-up old jalopy. You could hear the moans from the trailer. A lot of fish were slamming against the aluminum. It was actually swaying back and forth. In the cab there was a very wealthy investment banker from Xi'an. He'd made a lot of money buying up American credit card debt. He had enough to pay for his entire extended family. The man's Armani suit was rumpled and torn. There were scratch marks down the side of his face, and his eyes had that frantic fire I was starting to see more of every day. The driver's eyes had a different look, the same one as me, the look that maybe money wasn't going to be much good for much longer. I slipped the man an extra 50 and wished him luck. That was all I could do.
Where was the truck headed?
Kyrgyzstan.
Meteora, Greece. The monasteries are built into the steep, inaccessible rocks, some buildings sitting perched atop high, almost vertical columns. While originally an attractive refuge from the Ottoman Turks, it later proved just as secure from the living dead. Post-war staircases, mostly metal or wood, and all easily retractable, cater to the growing influx of both pilgrims and tourists. Meteora has become a popular destination for both groups in recent years. Some seek wisdom and spiritual enlightenment. Some simply search for peace. Stanley MacDonald is one of the latter. A veteran of almost every campaign across the expanse of his native Canada, he first encountered the living dead during a different war, when the 3rd Battalion of Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry was involved in drug interdiction operations in Kyrgyzstan.
Now please don't confuse us with the American Alpha teams. This was long before their deployment, before the panic, before the Israeli self-quarantine. This was even before the first major public outbreak in Cape Town. This was just at the beginning of the spread, before anybody knew anything about what was coming. Our mission was strictly conventional. Opium and hash, the primary export crop of terrorists around the world. That's all we'd ever encountered in that rocky wasteland. Traders and thugs and locally hired muscle. That's all we expected. That's all we were ready for. The cave entrance was easy to find. We'd tracked it back from the blood trail leading to the caravan. Right away, we knew something was wrong. There were no bodies. Rival tribes always left their victims laid out and mutilated as a warning to others. There was plenty of blood. Blood and bits of brown rotting flesh, but the only corpses we found were the pack mules. They'd been brought down, not shot, by what looked like wild animals. Their bellies were torn out and large bite wounds covered their flesh. We guessed it had to be wild dogs. Packs of those damn things roamed the valleys, big and nasty as Arctic wolves. What was most puzzling was the cargo. Still in their saddlebags or just scattered about the bodies. Now, even if this wasn't a territorial hit, even if it was a religious or tribal revenge killing, no one just abandons 50 kilos of prime, raw, bad brown heroin or perfectly good assault rifles or expensive personal trophies like watches, mini disc players, and GPS locators. The blood trail led up the mountain path from the massacre in the Wadi. A lot of blood. Anyone who lost that much wouldn't be getting up again. Only somehow he did. He hadn't been treated. There were no other track marks. From what we could tell, this man had run, bled, fallen face down. We could still see his bloody face mark imprinted in the sand. Somehow, without suffocating, without bleeding to death, he'd lain there for some time, then just gotten up again and started walking. These new tracks were very different from the old. They were slower, closer together. His right foot was dragging, clearly why he'd lost his shoe, an old worn-out Nike high top. The drag marks were sprinkled with fluid, not blood, not human, but droplets of hard, black-crusted ooze that none of us recognized. We followed these and the drag marks to the entrance of the cave. Now, there was no opening fire, no reception of any kind. We found the tunnel entrance, unguarded and wide open. Immediately, we began to see bodies. Men killed by their own booby traps. They looked like they'd been trying, running, to get out. Beyond them, in the first chamber, we saw our first evidence of a one-sided firefight. One-sided because only one wall of the cavern was pockmarked by small arms. Opposite that wall were the shooters. They'd been torn apart. Their limbs, their bones, shredded and gnawed. Some still clutching their weapons. One of those severed hands, with little Makarov still in the grip, the hand was missing a finger. I found it across the room, along with the body of another unarmed man who'd been hit over 100 times. Several rounds had taken the top of his head off. My finger was still stuck between his teeth. Every chamber told a similar story. We found smashed barricades, discarded weapons. We found more bodies or pieces of them. Only the intact ones died from headshots. We found meat, chewed, pulped flesh bulging from their throats and stomachs. You could see by the blood trails, the footprints, the shell casings, and pock marks that the entire battle had originated from the infirmary. We discovered several cots, all bloody. At the end of the room, we found a headless, I'm guessing, doctor lying on the dirt floor next to a cot with soiled sheets and clothes and an old, left-footed, worn-out Nike high top. The last tunnel we checked had collapsed from the use of a booby-trapped demolition charge. A hand was sticking out of the limestone. It was still moving. I reacted from the gut, leaned forward, grabbed the hand. I felt that grip, like steel, almost crushed my fingers. I pulled back, tried to get away. It wouldn't let me go. I pulled harder, dug my feet in. First, the arm came free, then the head. The torn face, the wide eyes and gray lips, then the other hand grabbing my arm and squeezing. Then came the shoulders. I fell back, the thing's top half, coming with me. The waist down was still jammed under the rock, still connected to the upper torso by a line of entrails. It was still moving, still clawing me, trying to pull my arm into its mouth. I reached for my weapon. The burst was angled upward, connecting just under and behind the chin and spraying its brains across the ceiling above us. I'd been the only one in the tunnel when it happened. I was the only witness.
He pauses before speaking.
Exposure to unknown chemical agents. That's what they told me back in Edmonton. That or an adverse reaction to our own prophylactic medication. They threw in a healthy dose of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, for good measure. I just needed rest. Rest and long-term evaluation. Evaluation. That's what happens when it's your own side. It's only interrogation when it's the enemy. They teach you how to resist the enemy, how to protect your mind and spirit. They don't teach you how to resist your own people, especially people who think they're trying to help you see the truth. They didn't break me. I broke myself. I wanted to believe them, and I wanted them to help me. I was a good soldier, well-trained, experienced. I knew what I could do to my fellow human beings and what they could do to me. I thought I was ready for anything.
He looks out at the valley, his eyes unfocused.
Who in his right mind could have been ready for this?
The Amazon Rainforest, Brazil. I arrive blindfolded, so as not to reveal my host's location. Outsiders call them the Yanomami, the fierce people. And it is unknown whether this supposedly warlike nature, or the fact that their new village hangs suspended from the tallest trees, was what allowed them to weather the crisis as well, if not better, than even the most industrialized nation. It is not clear whether Fernando Oliveira, the emaciated, drug-addicted white man from the edge of the world, is their guest, mascot, or prisoner.
I was still a doctor. That's what I told myself. Yes, I was rich, and getting richer all the time, but at least my success came from performing necessary medical procedures. I wasn't just slicing and dicing little teenage noses or sewing Sudanese pintos onto she-boy pop divas. I was still a doctor. I was still helping people. And if it was so immoral to the self-righteous, hypocritical North, why did their citizens keep coming? The package arrived from the airport an hour before the patient, packed in ice in a plastic picnic cooler. Hearts are extremely rare. Not like livers or skin tissue, and certainly not like kidneys, which, after the presumed consent law was passed, you could get from almost any hospital or morgue in the country.
Was it tested?
For what? In order to test for something, you have to know what you're looking for. We didn't know about walking plague then. We were concerned with conventional ailments, hepatitis or HIV/AIDS, and we didn't even have time to test for those.
Why is that?
Because the flight had already taken so long. Organs can't be kept on ice forever. We were already pushing our luck with this one.
Where had it come from?
China, most likely. My broker operated out of Macau. We trusted him. His record was solid. When he assured us that the package was clean, I took him at his word. I had to. He knew the risks involved, so did I, so did the patient. Herr Muller, in addition to his conventional heart ailments, was cursed with the extremely rare genetic defect of dextrocardia with situs inversus. His organs lay in their exact opposite position. The liver was on the left side, the heart entryways on the right, and so on. You see the unique situation we were facing. We couldn't have just transplanted a conventional heart and turned it backward. It just doesn't work that way. We needed another fresh, healthy heart from a donor with exactly the same condition. Where else but China could we find that kind of luck?
It was luck?
And political expediency. I told my broker what I needed, gave him the specifics, and sure enough, 3 weeks later, I received an email simply titled, "We have a match."
So you performed the operation?
I assisted. Dr. Silver performed the actual procedure. He was a prestigious heart surgeon who worked the top cases at the Hospital Israelita Albert Einstein in Sao Paulo. Arrogant bastard, even for a cardiologist. It killed my ego to have to work with, under that prick, treating me like I was a first-year resident. But what was I going to do? Herr Muller needed a new heart, and my beach house needed a new herbal jacuzzi. Herr Muller never came out of the anesthesia. As he lay in the recovery room, barely minutes after closing, his symptoms began to appear. His temperature, pulse rate, oxygen saturation. I was worried, and it must have tickled my more experienced colleague. He told me that it was either a common reaction to the immunosuppressant medication or the simple expected complications of an overweight, unhealthy, 67-year-old man who'd just gone through one of the most traumatic procedures in modern medicine. I'm surprised he didn't pat me on the head, the prick. He told me to go home, take a shower, get some sleep, maybe call a girl or two, relax. He'd stay and watch him and call me if there was any change.
Oliveira purses his lips angrily and chews another wad of the mysterious leaves at his side.
And what was I supposed to think? Maybe it was the drugs, the OKT3, or maybe I was just being a worrier. This was my first heart transplant. What did I know? Still, it bothered me so much that the last thing I wanted to do was sleep. So I did what any good doctor should do when his patient is suffering. I hit the town. I danced. I drank. I had salaciously indecent things done to me by who knows who or what. I wasn't even sure it was my phone vibrating the first couple of times. It must have been at least an hour before I finally picked up. Graziella, my receptionist, was in a real state. She told me that Herr Muller had slipped into a coma an hour before. I was in my car before she could finish the sentence. It was a 30-minute drive back to the clinic, and I cursed both Silva and myself every second of the way. So I did have reason to be concerned. So I was right. Ego, you could say. Even though to be right meant dire consequences for me as well, I still relished tarnishing the invincible Silva's reputation. I arrived to find Graziella trying to comfort a hysterical Rosie, one of my nurses. The poor girl was inconsolable. I gave her a good one across the cheek. That calmed her down. And asked her what was going on. Why were there spots of blood on her uniform? Where was Dr. Silva? Why were some of the other patients out of their rooms, and what the hell was that goddamn banging noise? She told me that Herr Muller had flatlined, suddenly and unexpectedly. She explained that they had been trying to revive him when Herr Muller had opened his eyes and bitten Dr. Silva on the hand. The two of them struggled. Rosie tried to help, but was almost bitten herself. She left Silva, ran from the room, and locked the door behind her. I almost laughed. It was so ridiculous. Maybe Superman had slipped up, misdiagnosed him, if that was possible. Maybe he'd just risen from the bed and, in a stupor, had tried to grab onto Dr. Silva to steady himself. There had to be a reasonable explanation. And yet, there was the blood on her uniform and the muffled noise from Herr Muller's room. I went back to the car for my gun, more so to calm Graziella and Rosie than for myself.
You carried a gun?
I lived in Rio. What do you think I carried, my Pinto? I went back to Herr Muller's room. I knocked several times. I heard nothing. I whispered his and Silva's names. No one responded. I noticed blood seeping out from under the door. I entered and found it covering the floor. Silva was lying in the far corner, Muller crouching over him with his fat, pale, hairy back to me. I can't remember how I got his attention, whether I called his name, uttered a swear, or did anything at all but just stand there. Muller turned to me, bits of bloody meat falling from his open mouth. I saw that his steel sutures had been partially pried open, and a thick, black, gelatinous fluid oozed through the incision. He got shakily to his feet, lumbering slowly toward me. I raised my pistol, aiming at his new heart. It was a Desert Eagle, Israeli, large and showy, which is why I'd chosen it. I'd never fired it before, thank God. I wasn't ready for the recoil. The round went wild, literally blowing his head off. Lucky, that's all, this lucky fool standing there with a smoking gun and a stream of warm urine running down my leg. Now, it was my turn to get slapped several times by Graziella before I came to my senses and telephoned the police.
Were you arrested?
Are you crazy? These were my partners. How do you think I was able to get my homegrown organs? How do you think I was able to take care of this mess? They're very good at that. They helped explain to my other patients that a homicidal maniac had broken into the clinic and killed both Herr Müller and Dr. Silva. They also made sure that none of the staff said anything to contradict that story.
What about the bodies?
They listed Silva as the victim of a probable carjacking. I don't know where they put his body. Maybe some ghetto side street in the City of God. A drug score gone bad just to give the story more credibility. I hope they just burned him or buried him deep.
Do you think he...
I don't know. His brain was intact when he died. If he wasn't in a body bag, if the ground was soft enough, how long would it have taken him to dig out?
He chews another leaf, offering me some. I decline. And Mr. Müller?
No explanation. Not to his widow, not to the Austrian embassy, just another kidnapped tourist who'd been careless in a dangerous town. I don't know if Frau Müller ever believed that story or if she ever tried to investigate further. She probably never realized how damned lucky she was.
Why was she lucky?
Are you serious? What if he hadn't reanimated in my clinic? What if he'd managed to make it all the way home?
Is that possible?
Of course it is. Think about it. Because the infection started in the heart, the virus had direct access to his circulatory system, so it probably reached his brain seconds after it was implanted. Now, you take another organ, a liver or a kidney, or even a section of grafted skin. That's going to take a lot longer, especially if the virus is only present in small amounts.
But the donor...
doesn't have to be fully reanimated. What if he's just newly infected? The organ may not be completely saturated. It might only have an infinitesimal trace. You put that organ in another body, it might take days, weeks, before it eventually works its way out into the bloodstream. By that point, the patient might be well on the way to recovery, happy and healthy, and living a regular life.
But whoever is removing the organ...
may not know what he's dealing with. I didn't. These were the very early stages when nobody knew anything yet. Even if they did know, like elements in the Chinese army, you want to talk about immoral? Years before the outbreak, they'd been making millions on organs from executed political prisoners. You think something like a little virus is going to make them stop sucking that golden tit?
But how?
You remove the heart not long after the victim's died, maybe even while he's still alive. They used to do that, you know. Remove living organs to ensure their freshness. Pack it in ice, put it on a plane for Rio. China used to be the largest exporter of human organs on the world market. Who knows how many infected corneas, infected pituitary glands, mother of God, who knows how many infected kidneys they pumped into the global market? And that's just the organs. You want to talk about the donated eggs from political prisoners? The sperm? The blood? You think immigration was the only way the infection swept the planet? Not all the initial outbreaks were Chinese nationals. Can you explain all those stories of people suddenly dying of unexplained causes, then reanimating without ever having been bitten? Why did so many outbreaks begin in hospitals? Illegal Chinese immigrants weren't going to hospitals. Do you know how many thousands of people got illegal organ transplants in those early years leading up to the Great Panic? Even if 10% of them were infected, even 1%.
Do you have any proof of this theory?
No, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. When I think about how many transplants I performed, all those patients from Europe, the Arab world, even the self-righteous United States... few of you Yankees ask where your new kidney or pancreas was coming from, be it a slum kid from the City of God or some unlucky student in a Chinese political prison. You didn't know. You didn't care. You just signed your traveler's checks, went under the knife, then went home to Miami or New York or wherever.
Did you ever try to track these patients down? Warn them?
No, I didn't. I was trying to recover from a scandal, rebuild my reputation, my client base, my bank account. I wanted to forget what happened, not investigate it further. By the time I realized the danger, it was scratching at my front door.
Bridgetown Harbor, Barbados, West Indies Federation. I was told to expect a tall ship, although the sails of the I.S. Imfingo refer to the four vertical wind turbines rising from her sleek trimaran hull. When coupled with banks of PEM, or proton exchange membrane fuel cells, a technology that converts seawater into electricity, it is easy to see why the prefix I.S. stands for Infinity Ship. Hailed as the undisputed future of maritime transport, it is still rare to see one sailing under anything but a government flag. The Imfingo is privately owned and operated. Jacob Nyathi is her captain.
I was born about the same time as the new post-apartheid South Africa. In those euphoric days, the new government not only promised the democracy of one man, one vote, but employment and housing to the entire country. My father thought that meant immediately. He didn't understand that these were long-term goals to be achieved after years, generations of hard work. He thought that if we abandoned our tribal homeland and relocated to a city, there would be a brand new house and high-paying jobs just sitting there waiting for us. My father was a simple man, a day laborer. I can't blame him for his lack of formal education, his dream of a better life for his family. And so we settled in Khayelitsha, one of the four main townships outside of Cape Town. It was a life of grinding, hopeless, humiliating poverty. It was my childhood. The night it happened, I was walking home from the bus stop. It was around 5 a.m., and I just finished my shift waiting tables at the TGI Fridays at Victoria Wharf. It had been a good night. The tips were big, and news from the Tri-Nations was enough to make any South African feel 10 feet tall. The Springboks were trouncing the All Blacks again.
He smiles with the memory.
Maybe those thoughts were what distracted me at first. Maybe it was simply being so knackered. But I felt my body instinctively react before I consciously heard the shots. Gunfire was not unusual, not in my neighborhood, not in those days. One man, one gun. That was the slogan of my life in Khayelitsha. Like a combat veteran, you develop almost genetic survival skills. Mine were razor sharp. I crouched, tried to triangulate the sound, and at the same time look for the hardest surface to hide behind. Most of the homes were just makeshift shanties, wood scraps or corrugated tin, or just sheets of plastic fastened to barely standing beams. Fire ravaged these lean-tos at least once a year, and bullets could pass through them as easily as open air. I sprinted and crouched behind a barber shop, which had been constructed from a car-sized shipping container. It wasn't perfect, but it would do for a few seconds, long enough to hole up and wait for the shooting to die down. Only, it didn't. Pistols, shotguns, and that clatter you never forget, the kind that tells you someone has a Kalashnikov. This was lasting much too long to be just an ordinary gang row. Now there were screams, shouts. I began to smell smoke. I heard the stirrings of a crowd. I peeked out from around the corner. Dozens of people, most of them in their night clothes, all shouting, "Run! Get out of there. They're coming. House lamps were lighting all around me. Faces poking out of shanties. What's going on here? They asked. Who's coming?